I'm Peggy Clark, and welcome to The Bridge. The Bridge features wise women and a few good men from different geographies and generations in revelatory conversations about what matters most. The Bridge is a podcast of the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan forum for values-based leadership and the exchange of ideas. Today, we're greeting you from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado, where unfortunately it's a little chilly here today, but I'm delighted to be joined by two incredible media personalities. Dr. Ruth is a psychosexual therapist who sprang to national attention in the 1980s with her live radio program, Sexually Speaking, which expanded to a national broadcast called The Dr. Ruth Show. She's written over 40 books on sex and sexuality, and she's the subject of a documentary called Ask Dr. Ruth, and she currently teaches at Columbia Teachers College and Hunter College in New York City. Welcome, Dr. Ruth.
Thank you so much.
And Molly Fisher is also with us today, I'm delighted to say. She's a senior editor at the website The Cut and a podcast host of The Cut on Tuesdays, which brings forward women's voices on culture, style, sex, politics, and people. Everything that women can't stop talking about. And I must say that it is the podcast that every young woman is talking about today, including my daughter and all of her friends. So the fact of having the two of you here together just delights me. So thank you so much, Molly and Dr.
Thank you for having me.
So ladies, you both have grown listening audiences among women because, among other things, you talk openly and candidly about matters of sex and intimacy. Dr. Ruth, in many ways, you carved the way from Molly's podcast when Sexually Speaking debuted as a radio show in 1980. But that was almost 40 years ago. Why do you think talking openly about sex and intimacy is still so difficult for so many people, particularly women?
So, a very good question. And it's becoming less and less difficult. And partly because of the media, partly because of the social media that young people are very much involved in. And very interesting because in August I'm doing a new edition, the fourth edition of Sex for Dummies, and specifically with material for that generation that you people are talking about. And I'm very concerned about two aspects in terms of that conversation, not just issues of sex, but issues of loneliness, issues of not finding a partner that you can discuss issues without worrying. Is it going to be the end of the relationship if we discuss that? And then I'm very concerned, and that's what you people are doing to combat, about the art of conversation getting lost. Because most people these days, especially the millennials, are addicted to that telephone. Now, I have nothing against the phone. I have a phone. I can see what is important, but I certainly don't want to walk into a restaurant and see a family unit and everybody has an iPhone listening to something else. Mm-hmm. Very, very serious.
It's a huge issue. Exactly. So, Molly, the young women on The Cut on Tuesdays on your talk show talk about their early misconceptions about sex, their first experiences, the details, what makes them horny. And it's often very, very, very funny, often like Dr. Ruth's shows. So why do you think they open up to you so easily? And what makes it easier for them to talk about it for you?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I was thinking about this a lot, actually, watching the documentary about Dr. Ruth, Ask Dr. Ruth, and seeing how she rose to prominence initially in the context of a radio show. I mean, there's a cliche in the podcasting world that audio is the most intimate medium. And I think certainly that's how listeners experience it. You know, hearing someone talk in your ears and sort of share these emotional experiences with you is really intense. But I think also for the people we interview, there's something that feels freeing about having a conversation in a room with one person, whether it's me, whether it's one of our producers. You know, you hear actually sometimes that, especially among writers, editors, people who wind up, because of their jobs, having to spend a lot of time online, they'll get kind of nervous about what they're sharing in written form online because, you know, there's an anxiety that maybe it will be somehow used against you or taken out of context or misconstrued or that people will get angry for some reason or another. And when you're just having a conversation with another human being and it's not something that can be screenshotted or retweeted or like anything like that, it's really liberating to feel like you have that kind of freedom to be honest about
and
something
intimate.
It feels
like for you, Molly, and also for Dr. Ruth, there's this huge pent-up demand that people want to talk about sex, and they've turned to your podcast and to you, Dr. Ruth. There seems to be a need for the, what you're doing in your conversations and what you're doing, that people really need to talk about sex, but it's difficult. So how do you get them? How do you, Molly, and how do you get them to open up about sex?
Certainly, first of all, I am very concerned that everybody who does a podcast like yours and who did what I did has to be very careful never to use a last name, never to use any exploitation of something that somebody tells you. Yeah. And the best, first of all, I have to tell you, you cannot do therapy on the air. You can only do therapy in an office of a therapist with the door closed. But you can raise some issues if you are very, very careful of not identifying that person, because I don't want anybody to walk out of a program of mine or of anybody else saying, why did I talk about that? So on my television program, as an example, I talked about the issue of abortion. At that time, as again today, a burning issue. And I never used real people. That's not what you are doing. You are using real people, and I used real people on my radio. On the television, I never used real people. We used actors and actresses that my television producer, John Lolos, came from the theater world, rehearsed with them. I did not know what they bring to me. But very important, that what they brought to me is what they would have brought to me in my office. And I could ask the most intimate questions, because that was not her or him. That was an actress or an actor. I could give advice and then say, go and see a therapist if this is not enough in terms of an indication of help. And I could say afterwards, I said, oh, how wonderful you portrayed that woman, for example, that had had an abortion. You did a beautiful job. She got paid and I could sleep at night. So it's very important that what you young people do when you talk about these issues, not to use last names, and maybe even to tell some people, which I did my whole career, you can use another name.
Yeah.
You can use Sam, you can use Larry or Rosa or whatever name pops into your mind. The issue of talking about sexual issues, for example, it used to be very difficult for women to admit to themselves that they don't have an orgasm. And this is very important, because no man, no lover, even trained by me, can bring her to orgasm if he doesn't know what she needs. So one of the accomplishments, if I can say so myself, was to be able to say, talk about the issue, and you have to be honest with your partner. They can't read your mind. And that you will see that in the documentary, very well produced. It makes me smile of how well it's done in terms of getting all kind of media involved about how difficult it is to talk about sex, and how maybe sometimes people would have said, if only my mother or grandmother would have talked like this. For some people, that talk, like the talk, was not possible. Leave it alone. Do what I did. I brought books home. I put the books on the coffee table, and believe me, I knew that my children were reading them.
They figure it out, yeah.
They figured out, and then I did say I want to be an askable parent. That's important for you young people, to be able to say, I want to be an askable parent, an askable grandmother, whoever it is, ask me questions. So I would say that today there are less women who have not heard that message, who are less women who don't know that there is such a thing as an orgasm for them. There are less men who have not heard myself, you, Molly, or anybody else talk about premature ejaculation. We have less men now who ejaculate faster than they want to because of the public media, because of the social media who permits that talk about sex.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Molly?
Well, you raised so many interesting points to discuss. I don't want to get bogged down in anything too long. But I mean, one thing, when you mentioned needing to be an askable parent, I think that's absolutely so important. And I think I was lucky to grow up with parents who did feel like I was able to approach them, talk about things. My mom is a family practice doctor, so she was someone who certainly always had a very approachable, knowledgeable, matter-of-fact attitude to this kind of stuff. But one thing that's been really interesting for me to observe, I don't have kids myself yet, but some of my slightly older colleagues or people who do have, you know, kids who are maybe 11, 12, 13, 14, kind of preteens, they realize are navigating a totally different landscape just because of the way phones and social media and the possibilities of texting and, dare I say, sexting have kind of reshaped the sexual possibilities for a new generation. I mean, they find themselves having to have conversations with their, you know, 13-year-old about what to do if a boy is talking to you in class about the kind of porn that he's watching on his phone right there, which just seems so wild. Like it's really a different universe. And I think even the best intended parents can have a difficult time.
Very interesting, especially for somebody, if your mother is a gynecologist.
Family practice.
Family practice. So very important to teach that these days girls are menstruating at an earlier age. We don't know why. Some people say because of nutrition, but we don't know. But we do know that we want to avoid that any 11 or 12-year-old girl goes to the bathroom in school, finds blood when she urinates, and gets scared for the rest of her life that blood is coming out from a place where she didn't expect it. Or a mother who is a good mother, but has never had that kind of sexuality conversation or talk, and did not talk to her son about nocturnal emission.
Oh gosh, yeah.
So that boy had wet dreams, and she screamed at him, "What's the matter? How come you don't go to the bathroom? How come you urinate in bed?" He didn't urinate in bed. He had a physiological happening of wet dreams, and that's why in today's world, we have to teach about that early. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, this is a physiological happening. Know that, and let's deal with it.
Yeah, it's all about demystifying it, making it less taboo. Yeah.
So let me ask, Dr. Ruth, you have the perspective of a woman who's graced this earth for 91 years.
91.
So lucky
and
to
still
have
talking
you with
about
us.
Sex.
You are a treasure. What is your opinion of the attitudes about sex in the U.S. today? Do you think they're healthier than what you saw in the 1980s, or what are your perspectives?
Okay, so it's certainly not true when they talked about that Americans are more uptight than other people in Europe, for example, Sweden or Norway or Holland or anybody. It's not true because we in this great country of ours have had the best sex researchers. We have had Kinsey, we have had Masters and Johnson, we have had Helen Singer Kaplan, who trained me. I was very fortunate to have the best sex therapist, psychiatrist in the world. I worked with her for 7 years. So we have to stand up and to say we have the best scientifically validated data. True that it was always difficult to talk about it because people always thought if you talk about sex, you are providing people with arousal, and then they are going to do some unintended and unwanted activity that maybe you did not want. So we have to speak up and say, this image of Americans being more reluctant is not true. It's just, it's a different way of teaching and a different way of learning. And now I just came back from England. I just did the Oxford Union debate. Many years ago I did it and I won. It was on abortion. This time my group lost.
Oh.
But you have to learn how to lose with a smile. And I just want to make so sure that people know that what you are doing, what we are doing, is not for arousal. Mm-hmm. It's for giving good information. The arousal should happen in the bedroom, door closed.
In specific situations.
Right. But the knowledge and the talk mm-hmm. about issues of sexuality has to be, and since all of younger people are hooked to the social media, that's what we have to use. So it's very good that it's all used for it.
I'm Peggy Clark, and you're listening to The Bridge. If you like today's episode, be sure to check out The Cut on Tuesdays, a podcast from New York Magazine and Gimlet Media. The Cut brings you women's voices on culture, style, sex, politics, and people. It's a space where women can bring the intimate conversations we're having with our friends and colleagues to a larger community of listeners. Recent episodes include a reflection on Toni Morrison's influential life, a discussion on how to fight back against online harassment and abuse, and a deep dive into the hot topic of abortion rights. You can listen to The Cut on Tuesdays on Gimlet Media, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. And now, back to The Bridge. So let's talk a little bit about how feelings and attitudes about sex have changed. And I'm curious, of course, about whether there's any relationship between our attitudes about sex and equality in relationships. And so, Molly, I'm wondering about the heterosexual women that you talk with on your show about sex. Do they see themselves on equal footing with the men they have sex with? And if they do you think that's leading to better sex?
You know, it's an interesting question. And I should say, at the outset, that I get nervous about generalizing too sweepingly, but I do think that for a lot of people, a lot of women roughly my age, I'm 32 or a little younger, kind of, you know, we were of a cohort that grew up with the messaging of like girl power and like the idea that like girls could do anything and we would all play soccer and excel in STEM and go to college in hugely high numbers. And, you know, I think we, or many of us, were accustomed to thinking of ourselves as, of course, on a level playing field with men. And so I think there's something, you know, particularly disconcerting or disorienting about finding yourself in, you know, any situation, whether it's a college hookup where you're at a frat drunk because the frats are the only Greek houses that can serve alcohol, and all of a sudden you're on the boys' playing field and you're trying to navigate that, or, you know, you're in a workplace situation and all of a sudden, you know, a male superior seems to be treating you differently than your male colleagues of your age. Like, I think for a lot of women my age, it's been a matter of having to kind of reconcile a certain idealism that we were raised with and that we maybe, you know, hope to make a reality, that we hope will be coming something that we can count on, with a world that has not yet caught up mm-hmm. with it necessarily.
And how is it translated into your conversations about sex? Do you think that women of your generation are feeling and approaching sex differently because they do literally have more equality?
It's interesting because I think that on one hand, and again, you know, my impression is that a lot of things are much less taboo than they used to be. And I think a lot of people have like a much clearer vocabulary, a much clearer sense of sexual possibility and of entitlement to sexual pleasure. And all those things are wonderful. But at the same time, I think, you know, there's still, it's not always easy, even when you have the words or have the ideas, to like translate that into something that works for you. And I think perhaps for some people, there's a sense that they should know what they're doing more than they do, rather than, you know, feeling like you need to be pure or virginal or anything like that. You know, there's a sense that you should be totally secure and know what you're doing sexually and know, you know, what someone else wants and all that. And it creates a new selection of problems or difficulties that you have to sort of figure out. And I think also something that I hear a lot from people around my age and a little older is that, you know, it can be easy to feel like you are indeed on quite equal footing with men in the context of sexual relationships when you're in your 20s, in your 30s, you know, kind of in the early stages of dating, getting married, whatever. And then the equilibrium really, really, really shifts as soon as kids come into the picture. And so I think that that perhaps is the next big hurdle that's sort of on my radar.
Dr. Ruth, what do you think about that? Do you think with more progress in women's equality, women are having better sex?
I hope so, but I'm old-fashioned and a square. And I have not changed my mind. And I believe that in a conversation like ours, it's very important to hear the different ages and different aspects. For me, I believe loud and clear that two people, two women, a man and a woman, have no business in bed naked if they haven't decided to have sex. The idea, can I now touch your left breast? Can I now touch your belly button? Can I now touch your clitoris? Is just not possible. Because at the height of sexual arousal, the brain flies out of the head. And in America, there is a proverb that says, God did not give men enough blood for two heads. So since I'm very Jewish, I use the Jewish tradition, the Talmud, very often, that in the Talmud it says, the sages were very smart, and in the Talmud it says that if a man is sexually aroused, if he has an erection, the brain flies out of the head. So it's the same like what I said about Americans saying not enough blood. So we have to teach that this is too dangerous to play with. If you have not decided, first of all, what you just mentioned, I don't talk to drunken people. If they are drunk, go to somebody else. I have no use for that. I don't care about a glass of wine. But anybody who is drunk, man or woman, don't talk to me about sex, because then you don't have that judgment. And then talk to me the next day when you are sober. However, it's important to teach that like what you said, that there's one building on campus that the alcohol is available. If you are not willing to be engaging in sex, then you have no business in that building. And I'm very old-fashioned and a square, and I stick to it. However, I do want to say a glass of wine is fine, because it helps you to relax a little bit, not to worry about the exam that you are doing in 2 days, but to be able to enjoy it. So I think that the conversation, and I think the books about sex, very important.
Mm-hmm. So I do want to get back to Ruth. We could talk all day together, and I know we don't have all day, but I wanted to, Dr. Ruth, Glenda Jackson, who offered an insight recently about playing King Lear as an older woman, her view was that the absolute barriers that define gender begin to crack as we get older. Do you agree with that view? Do you think that sex and gender begin to matter less the older we get?
I'm sorry to disappoint you. Because, first of all, I don't talk about anybody in the media. I don't talk about famous people. I don't talk about their sex life, even if I know a lot about their sex life. You will not know it from me. However, so I don't talk about that. I do say that because of our background in terms of that having been such a difficult topic, that for older people, it might take a little bit more of courage to start a relationship. Let's suppose a widow with a widower to start a sexual relationship needs like a start, like in the old-fashioned cars, like in the T-Ford car that you had to
crank it up.
It does need a little bit more. And for that, for older people, I say absolutely take a glass of wine. One glass of wine. But On the other hand, that's why I'm pleased, because there's no question that we in this country, that next generation is sexually more savvy, knows more, and still has a lot of problems. Because when they look at some of the media people, they think, oh my gosh, they have so much better sex than I do. And I'm saying, stop that. Just enjoy the sex that you can have at whatever age. I did a book called Sex Over 50, because I want to say there are certain things that are just scientifically validated and have been proved. For example, that a woman after 50, after menopause, needs to use a lubricant in order not to have painful intercourse. I don't want her to tell me the next day it hurts, because if she has intercourse and it hurts, she's going to say, who needs it? A man has to know that he has to have sex in the mornings when the testosterone level is highest, when it's easier to have an erection, and not at night when he tries to have an erection. Mm. Can take a glass of wine, but not more. So there's certain data that you really can teach, and it's teachable. So that's what we all have to do.
Mm, that's beautiful. So, Molly, as a wonderful, skilled interviewer, you must have a question you're dying to ask Dr. Ruth.
Well, I mean, in watching the documentary and reading so much about your work recently, I found myself wondering if there were particular callers or people who have sought advice from you who really, like, if there's a particular story that stands out in your mind as something that you wish you had handled differently, or that you, like, after time, feel like you would give a different answer to
that
person.
No, I'm going to tell you the story that makes me smile all over my face, that when I started the program on sexuality, the AIDS crisis came on the market. We have a lot of things to discuss about that, because I'm still worried about sexually transmitted diseases, not just for young people, for older people. So I think that the most important point that makes me smile is that a student, he was in his last year at high school. He said if he tells his parents, he was from Indiana, no names, and he said if he tells his parents that he feels attracted to men, they're going to kick him out of the house. And I said loud and clear, I have that taping still, keep your mouth shut. It's nobody's business. Finish high school. Go to a large university where there are groups that are attracted to members of their own sex. Then go to a large city. And that same now man saw me at a restaurant in New York. Said, Dr. Ruth, before you leave, I have to talk to you. That happens to me a lot. I go to a corner where nobody sees us. He says, you saved my life. I was that man who was attracted to men. And I followed your advice. I went to a large university. I'm now in New York. And I have a husband. It took me a while to get used to that word. I have a husband or I have a wife. Now it rolls off my tongue very easily. That made me really very, very happy and very pleased. Very often, to your question, Molly, very often I sounded like a broken record when I said, you have to see a gynecologist, you have to see a urologist, there might be something physical wrong, and call me back after you see a urologist or a gynecologist. And I was very much like stick in the mud. Of not worrying that I kept repeating that, that there are issues that you can never really help on a radio, but you can give advice and kind of direction of what to do with that problem.
Mm. And sometimes you get the sense that probably people, it's helpful for them almost to just articulate what they're going through out loud to a sympathetic listener. Yeah.
Right, because then they took the first step by saying, I seem to have an issue. Let me do something about it.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you asked that question, Molly. I'm curious for you, was there one for you that you felt?
Oh, gosh. You know,
about sex that was,
well,
you wished you'd handled,
mean,
differently. Or
people
something?
Don't come to me for advice, I should say.
Okay.
So it's sort of a different dynamic. I think usually we're interested, what we hope to do on the show is to kind of bring the kinds of conversations that women might be having among one another over a glass of wine or, you know, on each other's couches or after work or whatever, out into a more public forum so that people can, you know, feel a sense of community and feel like that kind of conversation is something that's shared beyond their immediate friend group and actually is happening across the country, across different communities, across different sexualities and genders as well, you know. So it's less a matter of feeling like, you know, there was something that I think we handled incorrectly necessarily, than always, I think, being aware. You know, earlier, Ruth, you mentioned how difficult, or not difficult, I should say, but delicate it is to think about questions of anonymity or how you're identifying people, or, you know, making sure that you're not exploiting people's stories by sharing them in the way that you're sharing them. And I think we are constantly weighing those questions and sort of reinterrogating the ways we've handled them in the past and trying to figure out what the most respectful and fair and also fair to our listeners way of communicating will be.
Right, right. So, Dr. Ruth, you get the last word. Is there?
I like that.
I love you having the last word. Is there any piece of advice you want to give women all over the world?
I don't talk only to women, but if I have to say women, is to say how fortunate you are that you live in today's world, how fortunate that you know that a woman doesn't have a certain amount of orgasms in her lifetime, but hopefully when she has a good lover, she can have, I don't know, millions of orgasms in her lifetime. And I'm very grateful that at the age of 91, there is a documentary, As Dr. Ruth, which shows also a little bit about the difficulty that was in talking about sexually transmitted diseases, the difficulty in talking about abortion. And while I told you that I don't talk about politics, anybody who talks about sex from morning till night has to stay away from politics, except I changed my mind. These days I do talk about how upset I am when I see children being separated from parents, because that's my life story, which you will see in Ask Dr. Ruth. And I certainly am very concerned about abortion having become again a political football, and that the funding for family planning, for Planned Parenthood, is so difficult to come by. So I have spoken up publicly by saying I don't do politics. I talk about sex morning to night. But I do stand up for those events.
Thank you, Dr. Ruth and Molly, for sharing your wisdom with all of us today and with so many people. I can't tell you how moved I am to have been with you here today. And thank you all for listening to The Bridge, a podcast of the Aspen Institute. Don't forget to download other Bridge episodes on your favorite podcast app, and also to buy the book and watch the documentary, Ask Dr. Ruth, available on Hulu today. I'm Peggy Clark, and thank you for listening.